In the coming week, U.S. and Iran tensions jolt the Mideast after the killing of Qasem Soleimani. The U.S. and China finalize the so-called Phase 1 trade agreement, and Taiwan holds a pivotal presidential election. It's January 9th, 2020, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Stephen Cook, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Stephen is CFR's ENI Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and African Studies and Director of the International Affairs Fellowship for Tenured International Relations Scholars at CFR. It's always a pleasure forecasting with you, Stephen.
Thanks, Bob. It's a great pleasure to be back with you.
Well, lots to go over, and let's kick off with the topic on everyone's mind at this moment. We are a day after a very busy night of back and forth between Tehran and Washington over an Iranian ballistic missile strike on at least two U.S. military bases in Iraq. Now, there was just earlier today, we're taping this on a Wednesday. Earlier today, President Trump seemed to walk back from an escalation of the situation. But it's safe to say there's a great deal of concern and anticipation about what comes next in the Middle East. Stephen, can you tell us what we should be looking for and sort of how bad this has gotten?
Yeah, you know, it was a very, very busy evening. 15 ballistic missiles fired at Al-Asad Air Base, the international airport near Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. Look, there is no question, there was never any question that the Iranians were going to retaliate. I think that they needed to retaliate in this way, in a kind of spectacular fashion because of their politics.
And symbolically important, the same timing of the attack against Soleimani.
Large numbers of people in the streets after Soleimani's death and during his funeral. In fact, more than 75 people were killed in a stampede during his funeral in his hometown. So I think the Iranian regime really needed to demonstrate some type of spectacular attack in Iraq. I think there's some evidence to suggest that they purposefully tried to avoid actually hurting anybody in this, although Iranian state media has said that they have killed Americans. The question is, what's next? And President Trump clearly signaled that there wouldn't be an escalation from the American side, which was something that people were worried about. They were worried that perhaps the president would take affront by the fact that the Iranians would have the last word. But clearly, the United States looks like Trump can portray himself, let's put it that way, as triumphant here. He has killed Qasem Soleimani, among the worst people in the Middle East, who is responsible not only for hundreds of American deaths and thousands of American casualties, but hundreds of thousands of deaths in Iraq, in Syria.
And his formal title was head of the Quds Force,
this arm of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And the Iranians shot 15 ballistic missiles that did no damage. So it's clear that the president can claim a victory of sorts. The real question is, now what? Are the Iranians done? It strikes me that there is a possibility, it's certainly plausible, that we go back to a sort of status quo where the Iranians are working through their proxies in order to try to undermine American interests and push America out of Iraq and other places around the region.
Well, that's a good point, Stephen. So maybe we can just start with Iraq, because it does seem like that is the arena in the forefront. Lots of mixed signals coming out from the U.S. about Iraq, first and foremost. The Iraqis themselves seem to want the U.S. forces out, but maybe not. Could you talk a little bit about that dynamic?
It is quite a confusing situation, and a lot of mixed signals are being sent. I should point out that there have been large protests in Iraq beginning in October against the government, against actually demanding a new political system. But part of these protests, a big part of these protests, were protests against Iranian influence in this political system. There wasn't a lot that anyone in the streets had to say about the United States. The killing of Qasem Soleimani has really flipped the script and now allowed Iran's allies in Iraq to frame the terms of the debate and demand that the United States leave Iraq. It's really unclear what the politics of this will be. There was a symbolic vote in the Iraqi parliament. They barely had a quorum in which they demanded the
United States. That's a good point. I mean, the significant population of Sunnis and Kurds, right?
Stayed away from the vote. But again, you know, the presence of foreign forces on Iraqi territory is offensive to many Iraqis. I was in Iraq in mid-December, and out in the Nineveh Plain, I came across a big sign that said, Iraq for the Iraqis. And that's, you know, the way people feel about it. Now, when it comes to the United States, it's really hard for me to come up with a strong case for why the United States actually should stay. We aren't pouring a lot of resources into the country. We have very little influence in the trajectory of politics there. We are fighting the Islamic State at the same time that the Iraqi government and party leaders are doing everything possible that might make a resurgence of ISIS possible. A lot of people made the argument, well, if the United States leaves Iraq, we're leaving it to Iran. Iran is the single most influential foreign actor in Iraq right now. So this may, and the Iraqis really really do not want the United States and Iran to be their battlefield. Again, going back to the important question of what might happen next between the United States and Iran, the Iranians work best in these gray zones where they're working through proxies, through cyber, in different places in the region where they can claim plausible deniability when everybody knows it's against it.
And that's why Soleimani was said to be sort of the puppet master of that, right?
Right, exactly. Now, from what I understand, that strategy predated Soleimani, but he really extended Iran's influence using that strategy, and that's really part of the mystique of Qasem Soleimani. The question is whether Qasem Soleimani's death will force the Iranian government to rethink that approach. Because clearly for the Trump administration, the plausible deniability doesn't work, and they were willing to take the dramatic step of taking out Qasem Soleimani. So I think that's the real question going forward is, are the Iranians done? Should we take their word for it? And I'm not convinced that we should take their word for it. The episode also raises a whole host of questions about the future of America's role in the region. As I said, it's very hard to divine a strong case for the United States in Iraq at this point. It's almost as if we're there because of sunk costs. We've been there for 17 or 18 years, therefore we must be there.
Well, and President Trump was all about moving the U.S. out of Syria not too long ago, and that was the earlier drama this a few months ago in the Middle East, right?
That's right. That was the drama of October. And so the president has stated, I mean, this is going back to his campaign, that he would like to reduce the U.S. presence in the Middle East. Yet the strike on Qasem Soleimani actually threatens the possibility of the opposite, of drawing the United States further into the region. After all, he's deployed thousands of more troops in anticipation of a possible retaliation on the part of the Iranians to Iraq and its surrounding areas. Iraq, I mean, we have Iraq where there's barely a state, if one exists. We have a zombie diplomatic presence there, yet we're deploying more force. It's hard to understand precisely what the administration's strategy is in the Middle East.
One other element, there's so many other elements, but one other place to note, what do you read from Saudi Arabia on this, that sort of the big rival of Iran in the region?
Well, look, it's clear that there's not a tear that's been shed for Qasem Soleimani in Riyadh. But I think, you know, the Saudis have learned that they remain unprepared for a confrontation with Iranians, either a direct confrontation or even an indirect confrontation. And after the missile and drone attack on Abqaiq and Khuris in Saudi Arabia, these two large oil processing facilities, the Saudis have looked to de-escalate. I am not convinced that they want to improve their relations with Iran. I think they want to live to fight another day. And I don't mean fight like a war, but live to figure out how to deal with the Iranian problem more effectively than they have. They were belligerent until there was belligerency, and then suddenly they understood that there were costs to their belligerency. And importantly, the cavalry that they had counted on, the United States, was not coming. The president chose, instead of military action against Iran in September after these attacks on these oil processing facilities, to apply sanctions on Iranian leaders. There have been rumors of a cyber attack, some other smaller types of retribution. But I think this was quite surprising to the Saudis, given what U.S. policy has been since the early 1980s, which is a secure of the free flow of energy resources out of the region, and an attack on it would be considered an attack on the United States. So the Saudis are clearly regrouping, seeking to de-escalate with the Iranians through third parties, reports go, because they don't want to be an arena of retaliation. And look, there's been Iranian violence on Saudi territory before. The 1996 bombings in Khobar Tower was pinned on the Iranians. So I think they have every reason to try not to be a target, but that doesn't mean that the Saudis are looking for some sort of warming of relations with Iran. Bob, let's shift away from the Middle East and take a look at what's happening in the U.S.-China trade front. President Trump's long-promised Phase 1 trade agreement has been drafted and is suspected to be signed in the White House in mid-January. A part of that deal, which was initially announced about a week ago, Washington suspended tariffs on over $160 billion in Chinese imports. What's in the offing, Bob? What is the deal? Is it a win for the president?
Well, I think I'll actually refrain from declaring wins or losses here, Stephen, but it's clear that whatever this deal amounts to, and there's still a lot of murkiness about some of the details, especially from the Chinese side, it has calmed the markets. You saw a surge and you saw basically this rally at the end of 2019, which the president likes to point to as among his achievements. You've seen, you know, general sort of relief and a sense that maybe there could be more pragmatism entering into this parley between the two most important trade powers and increasingly two most important powers in the world. But the realists and the people who especially watch the Chinese closely are saying, you know, there's not a lot there. There's not a lot of there. And really, phase two, which has been kicked down the road a bit, will be a real crucial point. There has been, as you mentioned, the tariffs. They're putting off the next round of tariffs. The Chinese have agreed on some intellectual property protections in a few areas, patents, trademarks, copyrights, and so forth. There looks to be a commitment on the Chinese side to up purchases, especially of agricultural products. Again, that the levels are a little bit murky.
That's the big question, is soybeans.
Right.
American farmers have really suffered as a result of this. This is a constituency of the president's.
Right.
Is he getting what he needs? Because his core constituency seems to have remained strong throughout, but he has certainly peeled some people away, especially in the agricultural heartland.
And as some would point out, you know, the damage is already done. There's some farmers who are not going back into business. There are a large number of farmers that this is just a death knell on top of bad climate conditions and other things that always make farming tough. This was just a death knell for them. And as The Economist put it a little bit cynically in their most recent issue, which is all about the U.S.-China relationship, Mr. Trump's tactical aim here is to help the economy in an election year. China is happy to buy time. You know, so there you go.
The Economist being cynical? That's a shocking thing.
So it will be interesting to see, almost as importantly as sort of the letter of the agreement, the phase one agreement, is sort of that gets the sign language around it, Stephen, and see what the two sides indicate. There's been talk of Trump going to Beijing for the next round. Maybe he wants to have some sort of triumphal gesture. Maybe it'll be during the election, before the election. We'll have to see.
You mentioned the realist, but it's interesting to me. I wonder what is actually making the administration tick on this issue. It strikes me from a purely geopolitical perspective. Separate the U.S. politics aspect of it and the damage to the agricultural sector of the economy, that in this kind of great power competition that is now upon us, it seems to me perhaps tariffs, a trade war with China, isn't necessarily a bad thing from that perspective. You're the United States, you're at the height of your power, China is still rising. Would it be worth it to take some points of GDP off of the Chinese economy? Well, you, the United States, can still afford to do that. And the question is whether you can afford to do it.
Right. I mean, I think one of the points that a lot of the experts make, whether they're economic experts or geopolitical experts or whatever, is that there's a lot of support actually out there for the U.S., out there meaning U.S. allies and other countries that have done business with China that would like to see China reined in a bit. It's got enormous influence now on the coming 5G technology. They are in a huge, important lead position on that. They have been, through their industrial policy, they have been, you know, taking steps against competitors in their own country that have been basically violating the spirit, if not the letter, of WTO laws. And they came into WTO, they were supposed to all be about being quote-unquote stakeholders, and they've not. And not to mention human rights concerns, which fly in the face of a lot of important values that countries, again, mainly allies of the U.S., hold on issues. And let's look no further than Xinjiang and the use of artificial intelligence there. So there is support, but people have pointed to the fact that the U.S. is far from sort of rallying allies in this cause, especially like European countries. You know, they've started trade tiffs with the Europeans as well. It's sort of in every direction.
They show up in Southeast Asia and demand things of allies in Southeast Asia, but they don't bring anything to compensate them by when they say don't do deals with the Chinese.
Exactly. So there were certainly seemed to be opportunities to bring China down a peg, but it looks like that's going to be elusive. We'll have to see how this pans out. The coverage I mentioned in The Economist, you know, they did make a point of saying, look, even if these two countries went full bore on trade war, the degree to which their economies are intertwined with each other and with the world economy are such that it would take almost a decade for an unwinding to occur, such is the state of and the importance of these two economies. So it's sort of like the issues are so big, they're bigger than everybody involved, but these are the two titans, right? So in some of the figures that you see out there, like even after the trade war began, there's something like 370,000 Chinese students at American universities in the U.S. right now. You know, just to throw out another number, there are more than 4,100 Starbucks cafes in China right now. I mean, so, you know, these are just a couple of little emblematic, you know, figures to throw out there, but it shows the extent of the relationship that things are still moving along even while there have been the nasty tariff spat that has consumed, you know, the last couple of years.
People love their Starbucks. But Bob, let's stay in Asia and let's talk about Taiwan, which is scheduled to hold a pivotal presidential election. Incumbent Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen, a member of the Democratic Progressive Party, is heading into the polls with a substantial lead over her main challenger, Han Kuo-yu. The Democratic Progressive Party takes a firm stance against Beijing and is attempting to make up lost ground after suffering a massive defeat in the 2018 local elections. Bob, what's the landscape for the Taiwanese election? And before you go, I just want to apologize to any of our Taiwanese friends out there for mispronouncing these two presidential candidates.
That's a regular feature of the podcast Jim and I do, is apologizing for pronunciation. but thanks for giving it your go,
Arabic
Stephen.
I can do, Turkish I can do, okay. You know.
Well, it is very much about, it's an important election. It's presidential, and we should also note legislative, because if the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party that you mentioned, of Tsai Ing-wen, does win on both counts and polls show a good chance, you're looking at a really major challenge to China in a year in which it's faced tremendous public pushback in Hong Kong. And Hong Kong sort of hovers over these elections, Stephen. It's since those demonstrations began earlier in 2019, you've seen sort of a proportionate rise in support for Tsai Ing-wen, who's polling very poorly about a year ago, but now polling very strongly. And she's been consistently about more Taiwanese independence and really asserting it. There's always been this, even with the fact that Taiwan has been this separate place with separate diplomatic relations, although waning in parts of the world, there has been this pragmatic streak, especially with the KMT, the Kuomintang, that at the end of the day, yes, we acknowledge we're a province of China's. We got to sort some things out, though. Under Tsai Ing-wen, it's a bit different. It's more like, well, we have distinct Taiwanese characteristics. We're a distinctly different place, and we're not going to get pushed around. And Xi Jinping, we should note, has ramped up the rhetoric against Taiwan. He's called for a one country, two systems type
renegade province.
Right. And he's been trying to sort of raise the pressure on Taiwan to accept a Hong Kong type deal. And the public is like, we don't like the way it's working out in Hong Kong right now.
So that was my question, is the protests that have gone on in Hong Kong since June and have grown violent over a period of time, and shockingly so, has that helped her in her campaign?
Absolutely. Yeah. Very much so. And, you know, these are two places that, unusual for Chinese speaking publics in the region, have access to open media, and they can see what's going on. They can see the reports. They can see the crackdowns from China, not to mention, as I mentioned, the reports coming out of Xinjiang and what's going on there. So that hovers over this. This is a place that, I should say, Taiwan, that's been democratic now for almost a generation. It's hard to put the genie back in the bottle, even though we've seen a year of retrenchment and problems with democracies around the world. Still in all, it's a feisty democracy, as is Hong Kong, frankly, and it's going to be, you're entering into a period now where if the elections go according to the way polling is showing, you know, you're going to have a real challenge. And again, this brings up the U.S.-China thing, because President Trump, while he wants a deal with China in this, you know, pivotal, important election year, he's also been much more willing to, for one, speak directly with the Taiwanese and sort of trample on sacred cows involving this relationship, which, again, the U.S. officially views Taiwan as part of China, but under the Taiwan Relations Act, it has pretty robust informal relations with
them. One can imagine, if you are a member and you're on the younger side of the Democratic Progressive Party, what is it that you remember about that connection to mainland China? It is seemingly over time a very different place. And
there have been economic ties, and that's another area that's going to be very intriguing to watch, because whether it's because of the trade distancing of U.S. and China or other countries' moves in the region, you might see a distancing after you had seen a closening of the Chinese-Taiwan economic relations. You might see a distancing of that, and that has interesting implications as well.
It strikes me that that is a geopolitical wedge for the United States with both Taiwan and China. So if the administration plays it correctly, it could be in a quite advantageous position on Taiwan. Let's see what happens after those elections.
Well, we've talked about a lot of figures, Stephen, and so that's a logical segue into figures of the week. And we've had our Twitter poll, which we like to do to see what's on the Twitter public's mind, especially the Twitter public that follows CFR. And resoundingly, the Twitter poll figure of the week is 480 plus million, as in 480 plus million animals dead. Stephen, what is this number referring to?
Well, I have to say, Bob, with all of the attention on Iran and Iraq and the possibility of conflict between Iran and Iraq, the fires in Australia are, from my perspective, the scariest things that have been in the news. And it wasn't just this past week. It's been now quite some time that bushfires have been burning all over Australia. I think the amount of territory that has been burned in Australia is now two times the size of Maryland. That is a huge, huge amount of territory. And in this fire that some have described as apocalyptic, there are many, 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 many animals who have died. Scientists say it's hard to put an exact figure on it. People are talking about millions, perhaps a billion. Regardless of what the actual number is, these fires have devastated the wildlife.
And this
Australia.
Is a country renowned for its exotic wildlife. Right?
Renowned
and
for
these
and
photos of koalas and so forth.
This is where you wouldn't find this wildlife anywhere else. Things like, you know, the world famous koala bear, or the kangaroo, but there's also the brown bandicoot or the long-footed puteroo. The long-footed puderu, its entire habitat has been destroyed by fires. In the state of New South Wales alone, 25% of the koala bear's habitat have been destroyed. And we were discussing this before. What is it that koala bears live on?
The Almost exclusively.
The leaves of eucalyptus trees.
Right.
And in this kind of heat, eucalyptus trees blow up. So it's been devastating for the wildlife in Australia. Only 24 people have died. There's been 1,400 homes destroyed. That makes it sound less than it is, but the pictures and the actual territory, 15 million acres have burned in Australia. And the question I think going forward is this the shape of things to come? Is this what climate change has wrought?
And does something like this in any way serve as a tipping point for a government that has been averse to, say, controlling emissions?
Right. The Australian government led by Scott Morrison. He is a climate change skeptic. He reversed policies of previous governments, and climate change skepticism or climate denial remains a potent political force.
We should know Australia, major coal source.
Major source of coal. The question is, and I think it's a good question, and there's no indication yet that it really has reshaped politics in Australia. There's, just before we recorded, I was reading about how those climate skeptics are now blaming environmentalists for the fires in Australia, saying that environmental policies have prevented the clearing of brush and the healthy growth of forests that have contributed to this cataclysmic blaze. I think the consensus, obviously, among climate scientists is that if perhaps the fire wasn't caused by climate change, it has been intensified by climate change. And it's very, very scary, not just for Australians, but if you look at the American West. Now, California has a very healthy snowpack this year, but we just came out of this prolonged fire season in California that was very, very scary. That included power blackouts and more deaths. And is this something that in the United States, given the vast differences between Australia and the United States, keep in mind, but are we going to see more intense droughts, more intensive fires, higher temperatures that are going to remake the landscape?
No, there's so many manifestations. I mean, whether it's, and you also, you talk about storms, you know, devastating, incredibly high wind storms, rising sea levels, and on and on. So it's, we're beginning the year with a lot of sobering climate.
And it is, and this is an observation, not a political statement. It's very hard to understand climate skepticism. Much of it rests on this idea that you can't predict the weather. And of course, you can't predict the weather. Meteorologists don't have a lot of data in order to predict weather more than a few days out. And sometimes they even get the next day's weather incorrect. But climatologists have thousands of years of data and can clearly see the trend lines that the planet is warming, and that warming coincides with how much CO2 humans have put into the atmosphere. Anyway, that is really, as I said, it's probably the scariest story in the news. But Bob, who or what is your figure of the week?
Stephen, I'm going to start out with a fairly mellow number, two.
Two? Wow.
Two is an important number for Venezuela. And let's just note, as we're taping this podcast, there are so many things going on in the world right now, it sort of makes your head spin. But let's not overlook what's occurring in Venezuela now with another leadership challenge occurring. And I say two because, at least as up to taping this podcast, it looked like at the moment Venezuela has two leaders. That would be Juan Guaido and Nicolas Maduro. But also two men who claim to be head of the National Assembly, Guaido again, and Luis Parra, who the government sort of maneuvered into that position. But we've had a challenge. We had the internationally recognized opposition legislature kind of sort of forced its way physically into the building that houses the National Assembly, and they set up shop and they sort of started business this week, leaving questions of what next? What's going to happen? What will they be able to come back on repeated days? Will there be a crackdown? Will security forces fire on lawmakers? Venezuela's been through a lot, but they're about to go through perhaps one of their biggest challenges now in terms of sorting out domestically how they're going to get through this impasse as the country continues to be in economic freefall.
It's really extraordinary that Nicolas Maduro has held on as long as he has.
He was dismissed early as just kind of a flunky for Hugo Chavez, but in fact has maneuvered his way fairly skillfully.
He's proved himself to be a shrewd political operator. He's gotten some help from around the world, from Vladimir Putin, from Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey, from a variety of others. But the political and economic crisis in Venezuela is such that one would have expected expected that he would have fallen.
Now, and he's faced intense pressure from the U.S., which has really ramped up its scrutiny, its activities in the region to try to bring groups, and has gotten a number of regional countries on board in terms of supporting Guaido.
But it raises questions about Guaido's skill as a politician. Now, of course, there are powerful forces arrayed against him, but in the past year, there were the incredible destitution of the Venezuelan people. This is the largest movement of refugees in the Western Hemisphere.
4.5 million, perhaps, at this point?
Right. This is huge.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if not for 10 other huge international stories and domestic stories, we would be focusing on the situation in Venezuela since it is in the hemisphere. But it seems just incredible that Maduro has been able to hold on and that Guaido has not been able to capitalize on it with the support of the United States, with the support of his neighbors, with the support of Europeans, with the support of the Canadians. And Maduro is entrenched in Venezuela. It's tragic. My understanding is that the economic situation, there's been some economic relief in Venezuela. He's allowed for the dollarization of the economy to some extent that has given people an opportunity, some purchasing power to get the things that they need. But
they still have a crumbling oil infrastructure, and oil is the single most important asset there for a country that has the world's largest reported oil resources. And so it's worth pointing out, though, because we've been talking about this for a couple of years now. How can this country sustain this? And they're sort of muddling along.
I think analysts have to kind of rethink what we believe to be the types of developments that could lead to the collapse of a country. It seems, though, that President Trump doesn't seem very interested in this issue. He was interested in it for a short period of time. It looked like Guaido was going to make some progress and perhaps Maduro would fall. It didn't happen. And the president's interest in this has waned. What, other than keeping up these sanctions, what is it the United States is doing to help its ally Juan Guaido at this point?
I think, I think it's waxed and waned, as you've indicated. I do think there's been discussions with countries like Colombia, you know, what are ways that they can help support opposition and so forth, not just rhetorically, but materiel. Beyond that, I don't know of what the U.S. is willing to do. You know, I think it's wary of getting further involved in anything involving conflict at this point, given the things we've already discussed in this podcast. So I think it's a bit status quo for a while, with more sanctions, as always, being added to the plate.
So we can say with confidence that Nicolas Maduro will be the leader of Venezuela next week, and likely the week afterwards.
I would say with confidence next week. I won't go beyond that.
Okay, sounds good.
But we got one more figure to pick, which is yours. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Well, I'm going to go back to the well. Okay. And my figure of the week is General Khalifa Haftar, who is the leader of the Libyan National Army, which is an army. It is Libyan at its core. It's not necessarily national. He is a Gaddafist military officer who at one time was reportedly to have been a CIA asset. He burst onto the scene on Valentine's Day in 2014 when he appeared on Libyan television and demanded the end of what was essentially a coalition government and the establishment of a presidential council, ostensibly with General Haftar at the head of this presidential council. Anyway, it's a long story, but he's been waging a six-year campaign in his bid for power, a violent campaign. That violence has waxed and waned. It is now in full swing again. He launched an offensive against the internationally recognized government in the Libyan capital, Tripoli, way back in April. And he quickly got bogged down. But now Haftar's forces are making fairly significant progress in their fight against the government in Tripoli.
And there's an international aspect as
there
well.
Yes, there's an important international aspect. The Egyptians, the Emiratis, the French, a number of others have long supported Haftar. He is anti-Islamist. He is, you know, a strong man. He first positioned himself as someone like Abdel Fattah Sisi, Egypt's president who came to power through a coup in 2013. And despite the support of those countries, he didn't make a lot of progress. Recently, the Russians have been pouring mercenaries into the country that has had...
So you have at least two UN Security Council permanent members directly involved in this conflict, they're also weighing in on what the UN, peace process.
Right. In Tripoli, there is the UN-recognized government, yet the French and the Russians Americans are also supporting Khalifa Haftar. And I must say that the United States has publicly said that it supports the internationally recognized government, but I think it's clear that the United States is sort of playing both sides, trying to see who's going to prevail here.
And
anyway,
and the Turks are involved as well now, right?
Right. With the introduction of Russian mercenaries that has helped Haftar in the battlefield, the government in Tripoli is back on its heels, and the prime minister went to the Turks, and President Erdogan of Turkey has offered his support to the government in Tripoli. They signed a number of agreements, and now Turkish forces are on their way to Tripoli. Now, the Turks say that Turkish troops themselves will be setting up a command center and a coordination center, and they will not themselves be engaged in combat. But who will be engaged in combat are those forces that the Turks used in their offensive in Syria in October. What we used to call the Free Syrian Army, that the Turks are calling the Syrian National Army, will be thrown in the battle against Haftar's forces and Haftar's allies. They've been promised Turkish citizenship and presumably a fair sum to undertake this battle. So Haftar has recently taken the strategic city of Sirte, which is kind of in between Benghazi and Tripoli in that U along the Gulf of Sidra. And the concern for supporters of the government in Tripoli is that they will have to pour forces towards Sirte, which will weaken defenses in other places, and that what Tripoli controls is an ever smaller amount of territory, and that Haftar's on the march. The hope is that these Turkish-backed forces will turn the tide. Libya is something that no one is paying attention to. And we may wake up one day and there be a new phase of a civil war, or there may be a guy named Khalifa Haftar in Tripoli declaring himself the leader of Tripoli, which will likely not end the conflict, but enter a new phase, start a new phase of the conflict.
So I have to ask the perennial CFR question in this regard, which is, so what? Why does it matter?
I think it matters in a number of levels. First of all, there is this proxy war that is being played out in North Africa. And Libya is a very important producer of oil, has the largest reserves of light sweet crude in the world, the fourth largest reserves of gas in Africa. The Russians are becoming increasingly influential with Haftar. In fact, if Haftar prevails, he will owe them. And it provides the Russians with a foothold in North Africa. And if you look at the map, that's very close to Europe. And this is part of Vladimir Putin's strategy to sow discord in the West and weaken the Western alliance. And I think besides that, Libya's had problems with extremism, refugees, all of the problems that have had an impact on European politics are there in Libya. Of course, a big problem is that Libyans are going to suffer. But if you look at it from a geostrategic perspective of the United States, Europe being a core interest, the prosperity and security and stability of Europe being a core interest to the United States, Libya, and in fact, all of North Africa, is an area of concern with regard to that interest. Well, that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. The Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas wraps up next week. That is someplace I would love to go. I'm not, you know, I'm tech enough, but I'd just love to go and see this.
Tomorrow's Essential Robots Today.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is, next week, Tunisians mark the anniversary of the overthrow of strongman Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, the January 14 revolution.
Speaking of North Africa.
The January 14 revolution that really began the uprising around the Arab world now almost a decade ago. It's hard to believe.
And that being one of the few countries that can claim some stability.
Certainly, Tunisia has made strides in ways that Libya, Egypt, Yemen, and others have not. Absolutely.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge and Catherine Puppy for their assistance. This week, Zoe Collis was also our recording engineer. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Bob.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long.